This presentation experienced some bleed-in coming from an adjacent room. We apologize for the inconvenience.
My name is Cynthia Gehring, and I'm the chair of this session, 402, Archivist 2.0, Policies, Partnerships, Predictions, and Possibilities. Thank you so much for attending this session. Our format's going to be three individual presentations, followed by a question and answer period. And our topic is in response to the challenge posed in recent years to consider the changing nature of archives, from traditional to archives 2.0. Several sessions last year explored the transition of archives as a place with physical collections, in a transition to an environment with analog and digital collections, and also a safe place for users to interact and engage with these collections. Implied and even acknowledged in these discussions of Archives 2.0 is the notion that just as archives are changing, so must archivists adapt and evolve within our profession. When archival collections were largely analog, the archivist played a significant role as guardian or gatekeeper to protect our fragile and collections and provide mediated access to our one-of-a-kind material. In the 21st century, our profession is no less significant than 50 or 75 years ago. However, we argue this morning that archivists must deliberately evolve if we can ever hope to manage electronic records, curate digital collections, and perform our fundamental mission as archivists, the preservation of the past, the documentation of the present, and access for the future. Archivists are modern Renaissance men and women. We must know about our professional tenets and the subject areas of our archives, and we also must be familiar with the best practices of other related information professions. We need project management skills. We need to understand the economics of information and be systems-wide thinkers within our institutions. As archivists, we need to synthesize the diverse needs of current and future user groups with the requirements of collections in hundreds of different formats. We need to be proactive, not reactive. We need to reach out and partner with our colleagues in information technology, records management, data governance, legal counsel, and more. We need to be willing to challenge current workflows, develop new policies and procedures, and shift paradigms. Basically, we're superheroes. We need to collaborate on solutions, be willing to negotiate, and even settle for good enough rather than do nothing. We need to be service-oriented and prove ourselves to be strategic assets to our institutions and be change leaders adding value to our larger organizations. Our presentations this morning are going to be discussing the evolving role of archivists from different perspectives, public broadcasting, a large research university, and the thoughts and opinions of young adults on archivists. First up is going to be Nan Rubin. Nan holds a bachelor's in mass communication and sociology from Antioch College. She is a specialist in public broadcasting operations and facilities. For more than 15 years, she oversaw special technology projects of public TV station WNET in New York, where she created the WNET tape archives in 1999. From 2003 to 2010, she served as project director of Preserving Digital Public Television, funded by NDIP at the Library of Congress, supervising a team of 20 archivists, technologists, and television station staff to design a repository for long-term storage and retrieval of digital video formats. We are going to show a video first, and Nan's going to get started while I try and get the video up and running.
I want to apologize for the people sitting on that side of the room. You can't see me. It's hard for me to stand, so I'm going to speak sitting from this position. I apologize. If you want to see me, just move over here. I'll stand up for a minute, and I'll certainly be available for all the questions and everything, but I apologize because I won't be able to read your faces over on that side of the room. You got to start at the beginning.
The tape
that I thought I would start with just to get everyone in a good mood is a clip reel from a whole selection of archives at different public television stations that was used to introduce the concept of archiving to Congress and help create the American Archive. I'll be speaking about that a little bit later. And because we were showing this to Congress, we invited material from archives at public television stations from all around the country. So you'll see materials that are taken that reflect the geographic diversity of the public television system. You know how Congress is. They want to see their hometown. So we tried to oblige them as much as we could. But I thought this would get us off to a good start because it'll give you a good introduction to the environment that I've been working in on archives in video and public broadcasting.
Back in 1952, the Regents of the University of Wisconsin called for the establishment of a television laboratory.
And the beginning of a new and wonderful element in the cultural life of our city.
Tonight you join me in being present at the birth of a great adventure. If newness be its vice, then boldness be its virtue.
Let's look in the window. Who's in here anyhow? Peek in the window. Peek.
It's you. I like.
When they saw the Beatles, like that.
Nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung.
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child.
National Educational Television presents the WGBH-TV production, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Prospects of Mankind.
Mr. President, you're very kind indeed.
A future in which our country will match its military strength with our moral restraint.
For something stronger than that, that would have meaning to all these people who have been sitting here?
What percentage of the plainclothes men assigned to the division, to the 6th Division at that time, do you feel participated in the PAD?
Everyone to my knowledge.
Everyone?
Everyone.
Well, we got the interest bills, the diesel tax, the SEMTA tax, and auto emissions. It will be a busy afternoon.
All of our voices singing, a song we love to share.
Every time you hear us say the two words, all seven, you respond with, Talaga!
Where in the world is
Cartman, San Diego?
The Cyber Squad is back in business.
Thank you.
I had a great time putting that together. Give me a sec to bring up my slides. What you saw was a little bit of a taste of the world of public television. I'm sure some of you would have recognized some of the people in there. Probably there's very few people in this room that would recognize all of the people that we tried to show in this particular clip reel. In the era where everything is available on the internet, the public expects that public television programs are saved and findable and that they're ready for viewing. Because our programs reflect important documentation of contemporary social history, and there's life after broadcast. The public really loves these old programs and has a long memory for them, expects them to be available. And, of course, they're used very much in education by teachers, students. Public television, we work a lot in K-12, but, of course, higher education also uses these materials and wants them a lot. Plus, these materials are called on time and again by producers, journalists, documentarians who want to use them for research, other programs, all kinds of other kinds of material. Go ahead and change the slide. Keep going. You can see this is just, you know, again, it's just a tiny little taste to remind people what it means to be working in public television, what kind of material we actually are producing out there. Go ahead. However, in public broadcasting, go ahead and change it. Go to the next slide. We have no culture of preservation. It's really kind of ad hoc. There's been no mandate for preservation. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which was created in 1964 to provide funding for public radio and television, included in their charter that they could set up an archive and maintain it, but they never did. So there has been no money invested nationally in archiving, and there has been really no long-term system-wide commitment for archives. It's been a real problem. And because it's expensive, the only places that have really been able to do any kind of genuine archive have been some of the really larger institutions, like WGBH and my station, WNET. But there's materials all over the country. It's just not maintained and supported in a way that would be considered archival. Go to the next slide. Yeah. Now, we all know there's a long history of best practices for analog video, even with sagging shelves and things like that. Tape storage is a known factor. We know a lot about the kind of emulsions that are on the tapes. We know a lot about the behavior of the tapes and the formats and how to store them. And we've got things like labels that even when they fall off the boxes, they're human readable. A lot of times there are paper records that go along with the materials and sometimes records inside the boxes, et cetera, et cetera. I know you're all familiar with those kinds of things. We're, you know, this is the same thing. But that's not where we're at these days. Not just in broadcasting, but in video production and also in audio production, it's all digital all the time. Nobody is using any more analog materials. Yes, we're keeping paper records for, contracts and things like that. But in terms of our media, there's no more physical manifestation of the media. We don't have it. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but it's not like we can say, let's go for the good old days when we used to have 2-inch, helical scan videotape. Forget it. It's not going to happen. So with that all changed, go to the next slide. This is what our stations look like now. The black box up in the corner looks like an air conditioner. It's about the size of an air conditioner. It's actually a video broadcast server. There are 4,000 hours of programs on that box. Editing, broadcasting, over-the-air broadcasting, storage, etc. This is what it all looks like now. It looks just like your workstations in any kind of a place. It's computer boxes, monitors, etc. What it means is that if we don't have a real system for preservation for this digital material, you won't ever be able to find it or use it again because you won't be able to go back to that shelf that you stashed that tape 5 years ago and pull it down. The file might exist, but you won't have any tools to be able to find it. You won't have any tools if you haven't done the work beforehand to have put some kind of cataloging information attached to it, and you won't even know what format to run it on. So this is a really serious problem in our business. The Library of Congress gave us money through the NDIP project, which is National Digital Information Preservation Program, to figure out how to preserve this material in a usable and findable way. We're very lucky to have that opportunity to do that. I feel very thankful about it. And one of the things that we had to do was really look at what does it mean to have the production stuff that we've got right now. This is what it looks like, typical workflow in a television station. You can see that the programs and the files and various pieces of information go to many places. They go to many inputs and many outputs, and almost every one of those different colored lines means a different format that you have to use. You have one format for the internet. You have one format for broadcasting. You have one format for production. You have a whole different format if you're publishing it to the web, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So our preservation challenges are very big, and our operational challenges have to dictate a lot of what we can do. We can't come in there and stop these pictures and say, let's stop it and figure out a way how to deal with this stuff. We have to do it while it's kind of a moving target, because the stations obviously stay on the air and these programs have to be broadcast. So we had to make the case for preservation. And we had to make the case for preservation particularly in the digital environment, because people didn't have the experience of not being able to find their stuff yet. But it's beginning to happen that they're not being able to find their stuff now. And we spend a lot of time in the last 5 years introducing the concept of digital preservation into the broadcasting environment. The broadcasting environment is used to keeping tapes during the broadcast window, which could be 3 to 5 years. That's where the tapes, and after that, the tapes would get erased or put away or something like that. So even keeping files for 3 to 5 years is something that the stations were interested in. But keeping them longer than that, that's really the challenge that we're having to face. Because after that broadcast window expires, it all changes. So we're introducing the concept of archiving into the system and also having to look at the actual operational issues that need to be addressed when you go to a TV station and say, let's talk about introducing some archival procedures in what you're doing now. The biggest issue for a lot of the stations has really been workflow, because the workflow from analog into a digital production environment is radically different. The stations haven't all made those changes yet. But I will say that with a lot of younger people coming in to the stations to be working in television, they've got a much more familiarity with using editing on TV, using editing on computers and things like that. They're not used to metadata and stuff like that yet, but they understand what it means to have a digital production workflow instead of an analog one. And we're at the place now where we haven't completely shed the analog systems. We've got people that are still in the system that are really tied to those analog production workflows, and it's really a problem for us. So, you know, we're all getting kind of old and reaching retirement age, but it hasn't happened yet. So with the digital workflow, the planning for archival process really has to take place all along the whole workflow. You can't wait till the end when you put the stuff on the shelf. It really has to be incorporated right at the very beginning. And one of the things that we really were introducing to people from the world of archives and libraries and the whole idea of preservation is the idea of standards and metadata. Now, in broadcasting, people understand technical standards, but they don't necessarily know about standards for libraries and information storage. And metadata is a word everybody's throwing around now, but nobody in public broadcasting would even know what it was. So going in and talking about S&M and saying we've got to adopt standards for what we're doing and metadata is the key to the future access to our materials is actually a very big step for us. The next thing that we have to do is really look at the rights issues. And our programs are very complicated. They're really hugely complex materials. I mean, you saw from the clip reel, any one of those shows would have had music, would have had script writers, would have had talent, would have had animations, would have had titles. There's gazillions of things. It would have had archival material or material acquired from other places. There are lots of pieces that go into producing even a single program. And there are rights that are attached to almost all of those things. And in order for us to be successful in our archiving, we have to really be very clear-headed about approaching those things and figuring out what we can do to kind of untangle the legacy of rights that keep us from being able to either reuse the material, make it available, particularly to the public, who thinks that they've already paid for these things and they should be able to see them and that they should all be online. We looked at the whole question of preservation. We looked at what it meant to actually put a preservation repository together. It's kind of a mechanical thing, you know, actually figuring out what kind of a black box you need. That's really only one part of it. Everyone thinks, oh, you just kind of figure out storage. Don't you just put everything on a DVD? And the answer is you better not. DVDs are not the answer to storage. They're not the answer really to anything except being able to watch cool stuff like this. Storage is only one part of the issue. All of those applications, all of those many file formats, all of the information you need to be able to read all that stuff. Of course, as we're all learning, I think this certainly isn't something that's exclusive to public broadcasting. Once you turn the lights on, you can't turn them off again. Once you get that digital repository up and running, you have to keep it going. Otherwise, the stuff will be gone. And that's a very scary thought, particularly in an institution like public broadcasting, which is, you know, really kind of on the edges these days financially, to think that, well, they already know what it means to not turn their transmitters off. So are they ready to also think that they can't turn their servers off as well? This is a big issue. So the system can't do it alone. We've spent a lot of time also working on partnerships of various kinds. They're very important. Every institution in this room is probably bigger than the biggest public broadcasting station in the United States. So we're always looking for bigger people to partner with. But we've got a lot of resources that are very attractive, and we can be very successful partners, and we'd like to be able to expand that a lot. In the area of archives and preservation, we don't have the expertise to do it ourselves, and we certainly don't have the resources to do it ourselves. So partnerships have become very important. And finally, I would say finally, 2 years ago, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting realized there was a future in the past, and they recognized that the entire collection of public broadcasting materials in the United States was a resource that they'd never really thought about. And they came up with the idea, we helped them, they came up with the idea of the American Archive, we helped them a lot, which was to actually take a look at the materials that exist around the United States in public radio and television stations and in independent producers and set up a genuine archive environment to provide resources and preservation. We won't be able to do it all, but we'll be able to do some of it. And they're actually now, for the very first time, investing money in the project that they're calling the American Archive. And I got an email yesterday of a press release from Patricia Harrison, who's the president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, reiterating the priorities for CPB for the next coming year, in part for the congressional funding, et cetera. And priority number two was the American Archives. So we know that there's a real commitment now to invest in these activities. So we have a number of things that the American Archive is going to be doing. The first thing they're going to do, which, again, I was helping them with a lot, is actually do an inventory of what's there. We don't even know what exists around the country in radio and TV holdings. So we're going to do that first. And then we can actually come up with a plan on what we have to do to start dealing with the at-risk materials, put together some kind of a rational plan for cataloging these things in a way that can be shared. And also steps taken to actually preserve them and make them accessible. And one part of that will also be seriously looking at rights issues and legislation, copyright legislation that we can participate in, which would be a huge step forward. We've got a lot of possibilities for this. We've got also institutions that we're working with, like National Archives, like Library of Congress, IMLS, New York Public Library. There are lots and lots of organizations, plus a lot of the institutions, universities with library schools, universities, a lot of universities that have public broadcasting stations, we're getting a lot of interest and support for putting the American Archive together. And also looking at the expanded economic models, what it's going to take for us to actually run some kind of a facility like that. So after we solve the technical problems, we need to continue getting support from the public for these kinds of things. And we feel that we can use this material once it's available to really make it available to the public, and that they will embrace it the way they've embraced a lot of things in public broadcasting, and that they'll be very happy to support it because it really is the legacy and history and cultural assets that belong to the American people that have been provided on your public radio and TV station. Thank you. And as you didn't see,
Lisa Schmidt is speaking next. She's our electronic records archivist at Michigan State University in Historical Collections, University Archives and Historical Collections. She holds a BA in History, an MBA, and an MS in Information Studies, all from the University of Texas at Austin. In 2007, Lisa began working for Matrix, the Digital Humanities Center at Michigan State. Her work at Matrix included an NHPRC-funded project to assess and improve the preservation practices for the HNET academic email list. In a joint appointment with the MSU Archives as digital preservation analyst, she engaged in a year-long project exploring digital curation practices at the university, and she now works full-time on electronic records projects at the MSU, Michigan State University Archives. These include such projects as managing the development of the NHPRC-funded Spartan Archive preservation environment for electronic institutional records, and creating appraisal, transfer, and storage plans for the university's digital content. Prior to joining the information studies field, Lisa enjoyed a successful career as a high-technology marketing communications professional in the San Francisco Bay Area in Austin.
Disagree with their expert opinions about a 19th century figure. And then I later learned that the dismissal of the authenticity of the letter was based not on a handwriting analysis.
Good morning. The name of my presentation is It's Different with Digital, Influencing Curation Policy When There's No Mandate to Curate. I'll start out by giving a brief overview of Michigan State and the MSU Archives and Historical Collections, and then I'll talk about the role of the traditional archivist, how the archivist can expand on that role to play more of a policymaking role at their institution, how archivists at Michigan State are taking on more of this policymaking role, and then I'll wrap it up with some conclusions. Michigan State University was established in 1855 by an act of the Michigan legislature to create an agricultural college, and it became the nation's Pioneer Land-Grant College in 1862. MSU has grown to a Tier 1 research university with significant national and global impact. As the nation's first agricultural college, MSU established itself as a leader in innovation and technology. And in fall of 2008, we had more than 46,000 students enrolled, with 10,000 of those at the graduate and professional level. Yeah, we are a cow college. This is Belle Sarcastic. She's a legendary cow who set the world's record for milk production in 1897. That was 23,190 pounds of milk, in case you were wondering. She held that record for 11 years. It's fun facts at the MSU Archives. The MSU Archives and Historical Collections is the official repository for the Historical Archives of the University. It was established by mandate of the Board of Trustees in 1969, so last year was our 40th anniversary. The mandate was to collect and preserve the historical records of MSU to provide the university community, scholars, and the general public with access to the records, and our director, Cynthia here, has the final say in disposition and destruction of records. And we have 33,000 cubic feet of university records. And this is a list of the subjects that are covered. And in addition to keeping the records of the university, we have more than 700 historical collections that are related to Michigan and the Great Lakes region. The MSU Archives also has the records management function for the university. We actively assist MSU units in efficient administration and management of the official university records, which includes the management collection and preservation of electronic records. So before I can talk about the archivist's role with digital curation policy, I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of the traditional archivist, and I'm sure you all are familiar with these definitions that are on the online SAA glossary. The first one defines an archivist as an individual responsible for appraising, acquiring, arranging, describing, preserving, and providing access to records of enduring value according to the principles of provenance, original order, and collective control to protect the material's authenticity and context. In addition, the Academy of Certified Archivists has identified these seven domains, which basically cover everything in the definition, these seven domains of archival practice. So getting back to our definition, the traditional archivist is the custodian of records of enduring and historical value to the institution. Manuscripts and other physical archival material is physically accessioned into the archives with the life cycle model of managing records typically employed. That is, the unit or department handles the records as they see fit during their time of use, and the archivist doesn't usually get involved until disposition. So the digital archivist's dilemma is that electronic records are now proliferating all over their campus or organization. These records may or may not belong in the archives, although those of enduring historical value should go to the archives eventually. The records continuum model of managing records applies more to electronic records if they must be managed properly at time of creation, or they may become more difficult to preserve later. But the archivist has no mandate to curate records that aren't in the archive's custody. So what is the archivist to do about electronic records? They can expand on their traditional role as custodians of physical historical material and become policymakers and influencers for the care of digital material. I have a few quotes from some of the leaders in our field. This one's from Richard Cox. The institutional archive needs to assume more of a policy role, identifying records throughout the campus and working to ensure that digital records are both maintained by their creators and
President of the United States.
And here's one from David Behrman.
On April 14, 1865, a man standing in the shadows of President Abraham Lincoln's theater box fired one final shot.
We need to stop disciplining
it was the
data
first assassination of an American president. And John Wilkes Booth's motives have been questioned and studied
so
for generations.
Provide guidelines to help records
now,
creators
almost
prepare
150
files for
years later, Marsha Mullen of Nashville,
of course,
Tennessee, has learned of a letter supposedly written by John
Some
Wilkes Booth's father to another American president.
Today, somebody would be taken off to jail in 5 minutes for writing a letter like that.
Marsha has invited me to the Hermitage,
anyway.
President Andrew Jackson's family home in Nashville,
may remain in
where
the
she is
of
chief curator.
So what do you have
guidelines
for?
And best practices
well,
in
a couple of years ago, a visitor brought to our attention this
archivists,
letter,
archivists, especially those with a background in electronic records, have the knowledge and expertise to do this.
I really didn't know anything
so
about
So what kind of expertise
so
does the archivist
I got a copy
have
of
in assisting creating policies and guidelines?
The signature on the death threat reads, Junius Brutus Booth.
Junius Brutus Booth was a very famous actor,
property.
But interestingly
we know
enough,
about file naming conventions and metadata
father,
analysis and recommendations.
Now that's
and
an interesting connection.
These areas
it's very
do
interesting.
To the ACA
it's dated the 4th of July, 1835,
course,
from Brower's Hotel, Philadelphia.
Legal you damned old scoundrel, I will cut your throat whilst you are sleeping.
He's insisting that Jackson pardon two men
digital
on death row.
Also offers
I'll have you
in digital
burnt
preservation. Including
City of
file
Washington.
Format recommendations,
your master,
file authenticity and integrity
Junius
checking methods,
Brutus Booth.
Repositories and repository
Man,
software,
now this is a
and
threat.
Trusted digital repositories.
So the father
knowledge.
Of the guy who killed Lincoln
digital archivist,
threatened to assassinate a president.
And backup and,
well, that's the question.
Traditional archivists
because
as
when
well,
you look at the back
have,
of the letter, someone has written anonymous.
Planning.
And so that was very curious. Is
so to be a policymaker, the archivist must show an interest in and take responsibility for the welfare of digital assets at his or her institution.
We'd like to know if Junius
they need
Bruce
to learn to
Bruce
speak
really
IT language
letter,
to better understand and work
why?
With those who design and support
Well, let me see if I can find an answer to your question.
They need to be able to provide guidance, create policy, and intervene when appropriate. They must be able to educate on, influence, and facilitate the curation of digital assets as needed to play a consulting role at their institution. So now I'm going to talk about what we've been doing at Michigan State. We're involved in a number of electronic records initiatives in which we're playing the roles of offering guidance and, in some cases, actually creating policy. I've listed some of the projects here, and I'm going to go into more detail on them in a few minutes. And here are some more.
Have you ever seen this letter before?
Oh, yes.
So I'll start out by talking about the Digital Curation Planning Project, in which we set out to assess the digital assets, technical infrastructures, and the state of the digital curation needs.
Dan explains that President Jackson's strong hand and often unpopular policies had made him a lightning rod for criticism and threats. 6 months before our letter was written, he was the victim of the first assassination attempt against an American president. A deranged house painter attempted to shoot him outside the Capitol building, but the pistol misfired.
Shortly after that, the Washington Globe published several columns
to that,
of assassination letters that it said Jackson had received.
Those questionnaire responses, we followed up with in-depth interviews with 10 select units. We evaluated their preservation practices, their technical infrastructures, and their use of metadata. And we
concluded with recommendations and next steps. Every historian previous to us, every Jackson biographer, has assumed that Booth didn't write it. Someone
in
his office.
One outcome of the project was the identification
of
four types of
digital content at Michigan
State.
Probably wrote this word.
Jackson did not write it.
It doesn't appear to be
Jackson's handwriting.
Has there been an analysis of the handwriting in this letter?
As far as I know, no one has ever taken it to that step because they thought it was unnecessary.
Non-MSU content of
that
interest,
seems a
such
curious
as libraries
omission.
Of cultural material that are created
the Folger
and
Shakespeare
by
Library
students.
In Washington, D.C. has several Julius Booth letters in their collection. Heather Wolf is curator
the archives
of
can offer guidance on
she's
how to
made
care
special
for
arrangements with the Library of
types.
Congress to obtain the
we
original
can share digital curation
Jackson.
Good practice Heather, guidelines
nice
with the units responsible
so
for
so this
content.
Is the original letter.
And we can work with Central IT
I
to develop good storage options, which I'm
our
going to talk about in a minute,
and
repository
analysis.
Solutions
I picked
for
these
the research
two letters
data.
Because they were closest
as many of you
in
know,
date
the National Science Foundation will begin requiring a data management plan for the project.
It's the first time Heather has seen the original letter to Jackson, and a couple of items strike her as odd.
He signs the letter to Jackson with his full name, Junius Brutus Booth. All of the letters at the Folger
are signed
J.B.
actually has some degree
Booth,
of policy enforcement authority for some of the content
signature.
Types.
The rest of the letter looks as if it could have flowed from the same pen.
An institutional repository,
here,
as well as
I
the content of historical
cautions.
Values of the
you
university,
see the bottom
which
of
will eventually
see how
come
it
into
loops
the custody
around
of the
dramatically.
Archives.
Well, in this letter here, we see the word
as part of the digital curation
same,
planning project,
very
the archives is providing
see,
assistance to university relations, the campus unit that provides public relations services to the university.
He has
their servers
the
are practically bursting at the seams with digital
teams.
Photo and video
so
files.
So if you look at the word
some
the
of these are records of historical
letter,
value to the university.
The crossbar
they fit into that
across,
category of content,
T,
but we have a particular interest
H&E.
In providing curation
guidance. If Booth didn't write
on.
This himself,
and
she
at some
says
point
the
we
forger
will
was at the top of his class.
We will be offering inventory and appraisal
Heather's
guidelines,
made
storage
discovery.
Options through plans
this
developed
this letter from
IT,
1834
and custody and file
mentions that he needed to escape the farm
one
for a couple
exciting
of days
project
and go to
that
Philadelphia.
We're starting on is the Spartan
says,
Archive.
Therefore, I strolled to Philadelphia, Brower's Hotel,
to develop
is
a permanent archive
the best in
to preserve
city.
MSU's institutional
so he has a
records
history of frequenting
value.
The Brower's Hotel
this
in
grant,
Philadelphia.
We start,
so
we
what do you
working
think?
On this past
did
April,
Junius Brutus Booth
is taking
write
a proof
letter?
Of concept
based
approach to test the sustainability
alone,
of an archival
yes,
solution
it is a Junius
for long-term access and preservation of free electronic record series produced by the Registrar's Office.
That's a question for Booth scholars. We need to find out more about the context of the letter.
And one big piece of developing this archive will be the creation of policies and documentation. And then once we complete it, we plan to extend it, the trusted repository, to accession other digital records of enduring value to the university.
Hey, Dan, how you doing?
It's Dan Feller.
Of course, we
seems
actually
our
do
meeting
have a
prompted him
to
do some additional
material.
Research.
As opposed to some of the
I tell Dan
other
about the handwriting comparison
about,
and what else I've learned about Junius Booth.
Work, and,
it's been suggested
gonna, again,
to me that Jackson
to
and
the
Booth were actually
the
friends and that this
another
letter
area that we have a mandate
in
to influence
I doubt
records
that very
management.
Much.
When
have
I describe the role of the MSU
of
archives at the beginning of this presentation, remember that
we
one
know
of our functions
no
is to actively assist MSU units in efficient administration.
His team has uncovered several new pieces of information.
And to that
our letters
end,
dated July 4th.
He's been able to figure out Booth's whereabouts that day.
These are educate the units
newspaper
the best,
advertisements
best
showing that Booth was indeed in Philadelphia on July 3rd and 4th. He was scheduled to play Othello on the 3rd
administrators
at the Chestnut
like the
Street Theater.
Record,
I see.
And scheduled to play Richard III on the 4th.
What not to keep.
That puts Booth in Philadelphia at the time the letter was written.
Practices
and here's the real clincher. This is another letter that Booth wrote in August
imaging,
of 1835.
Document management.
He apologizes for the ungrateful and shameful conduct I have evinced toward the worthy managers of the Chestnut
Street
Theater.
So the archives is providing
the units
with the
Friday,
guidance
July 3rd,
getting the word
Saturday
out
the 4th.
That we can help.
In fact, he did not play on July 3rd and 4th. He didn't show up.
So he was there,
Cynthia
and maybe one of his fits of madness did not perform.
Exactly.
But as for threatening to assassinate the president,
this multi-year
I still don't have a smoking gun.
But look further down in the letter.
There,
creating streamlined
at the
business
end,
processes
Junius Booth himself
administrative
gives me my final piece
finance,
of the puzzle.
My insane behavior.
I think I finally have an answer for
Marshall.
Very interesting investigation. Thank you very much for the opportunity to get into the life of Junius.
The archives will also be influencing
the
university's
that
the
handwriting
initiative.
Of this assassination threat
will be providing
other
guidance on the
creation
layer of the storage
That's
systems
cool.
to ensure that
really
there will be space for trusted digital
repositories. The circumstantial evidence together was an open letter from Booth that seemed to be an admission of guilt.
He says, my insane behavior in writing insolent letters to my best patrons and to the authorities of this country, I can scarcely
units
hope
just be throwing data.
The authorities of this country. You think he's referring to President Andrew Jackson here?
I'll bet he is, because one sentence
further also
down,
have
he says, may God preserve General Jackson
in
this happy
initiative.
Dan says our handwriting analysis and his questioning of conventional wisdom have corrected the historical record. President Lincoln's killer, John Wilkes Booth, was fathered by a man who also threatened to murder a sitting president.
And again, the archives
we had assumed, as those before us had assumed, that the real Booth didn't write this letter on the basis of that one word, anonymous. It turned out he did.
The archives
reminds us
is
always
or will
to check
be
our
providing
facts,
guidance in other
always
areas.
To go back and verify
example,
even when we think we know
all
what really happened.
Repository of policies
that is
modeled
amazing.
On the University of Minnesota
I'm shocked.
Policy
I mean,
Library.
It's an interesting coincidence
also,
that he wrote such a letter and that his son ended up assassinating Lincoln.
On the
thank you very much for the opportunity to
inventions, discoveries,
thank
know-how,
you.
Show-how, processes, unique materials, copyrightable works, original data, and other creative or artistic works. The Archives is consulting with the Office of Intellectual Property to ensure practical workflows, permissions, and the trustworthiness of the repository. The Controller's Office has requested help in developing a business records destruction policy. In fact, they've asked the Archives to write their policy. They work with confidential data, and they are especially concerned with data that might be automatically saved to today's smart office peripherals, such as fax machines and copiers. Also, Residential and Hospitality Services has requested guidance on a contract they have with Microsoft, which is hosting their email service. They were especially concerned over whether the contract would comply with the university's policy on spam control, so they asked us for help. So, there are some conclusions to be drawn from our experiences at Michigan State. As an archivist, you too can be a maker of digital curation policy at your institution. Archivists have traditionally been stewards of records of enduring value, including electronic records, and all electronic records can benefit from the archivist's curation guidance, regardless of whether there's a mandate to curate. Your archives and archivists can offer digital curation expertise and create and influence electronic records policy in addition to providing traditional services. Archivists can act as consultants. We're of the institution, but not necessarily invested at the unit level, so we can stand back, think about, and provide guidance on curation issues so the units don't have to. I just wanted to comment that much of what I've talked about in this presentation veers over into the area of records management. And at Michigan State and at many institutions, the records management and archives functions are linked. And at those institutions in which the functions are separate, the two still should work together, especially when it comes to electronic records, as curation needs must be addressed at time of creation. So get to know your records managers. In final conclusion, archivists can adapt and expand on their traditional role to provide value to their institutions, taking on policymaking and guidance roles in the management of electronic records to become even more of a strategic asset. Thank you.
technical testimony on both sides about where their ship
Our final speaker this morning is Joanne Kaczmarek. Joanne holds a master's in information science from the University of Illinois. She's the archivist for electronics records and associate professor of library administration at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where she investigates university-wide records and information management issues and challenges. Joanne's research interests focus on digital preservation and digital content asset management, with a focus on the intersections between business process and human nature. Prior to her current position, Joanne was the project coordinator for UIUC on the Mellon-funded OAI PMH Cultural Heritage Repository Project. She also has a video, but I don't think it's till the end, so we have to make sure we've got the right thing starting. Is that your video?
Thank you. All right. Well, my presentation is a little bit different from those of my colleagues here, but I think it fits in an attempt to help us visualize future possibilities for our profession, and in particular the archive side of the coin here. Clearly, electronic records and digital content are going to continue to present challenges to all of us for some time to come. And I think it's fair to say that for many of us, we're not always certain how we might fit into a future view of what this means for archives. And it's a reasonable question to be asking. So I'm down arrow here. Okay. So my motivation here is to give myself a chance to break out of my own worldview and try to imagine what the future possibilities might mean in the context of my growing appreciation for archives. I think also I don't really come to the table with some of the skills that many of you maybe were born with or have developed over a long career as professional archivists. And as an electronic records archivist, I don't often have the opportunity to work with the physical artifacts that many of you might be familiar with. But when I have had that opportunity, it has begun to open me up to an understanding and appreciation for history in a way that I just wonder what that will be like as we move towards more digital archives. So quickly here, what my worldview is at the moment, and it's always subject to change, is that I really do believe that technology is going to continue to influence pretty much how we all manage all kinds of information. And I think the individual will continue to gain control of information resources, especially in their personal world, but also in a professional setting. You may see more and more expectation that the archives become something that is managed more at the individual level. And the other piece of my worldview here is that I think the temperament of archivists is a little bit different from technologists, and I think it should be. And while what Lisa said is so important to keep in mind in terms of the role that archivists can play in our institutions moving towards managing digital content, developing different skill sets, I think the piece of collaboration with the technologists is the part that I like to focus on. I don't think all archivists need to become technologists. You want to be comfortable having conversations, but it's really okay to be what you are. So, okay. So in order to explore breaking out of my own worldview, I thought we might as well start with young people, because to get a handle on the possibilities of the future, it seems like this is the way to go. After all, the future is theirs, and most people that are what I would call young people don't even know a world without modern communications technologies. So I know this is a bit of stating the obvious, but pretty much the 20 and under crowd don't even rely upon paper documents or artifacts for many things that some of us are more comfortable with, such as representations of past events, assurances of contractual agreements. It's very likely that a lot of people under the age of 20 don't even have a concept of the wet signature. And they certainly don't rely upon communications or greetings with one another in a hard greeting card format. And I don't know about you, but these days I revel in those days when I open the mailbox and there's actually a letter from somebody in my mailbox, my physical mailbox, besides all the flyers for where to get cheap pizza for the weekend. So I wanted to understand what are the views of young people on technology and on archives, and This is actually a friend of mine's son that I found this picture of him on the web somewhat accidentally, and I still haven't had the nerve to ask him why it looks like this, but it was kind of cool, and I think that this is what I realize is that he's probably sitting staring at some screen, and some friend of his took this picture with the camera and then did some collage thing over it here. But to find out the views of young people, I decided that I needed to ask them questions. Imagine that. How do you spend your time communicating, and what do you do with your personally created information? And the answers that I got are not going to surprise any of you, I don't think. But nonetheless, I decided it was a good starting point for constructing a narrative about what this future might hold for archivists in terms of young people's perspective of technology. So the methodology here was to conduct a survey. It was 10 to 20-year-olds, but as it turns out, I had to bump it up a little bit because of the ability or inability to get participants here. I decided to use SurveyMonkey, and this is not intended to be a rigorous approach. As a matter of fact, I used my 15-year-old niece, and this is one of her favorite pictures of herself, to help me with this. And the idea was that I could gather information in a way that would be easy for young people to answer. And one of the things I learned was that I needed to make it really simple. She said, don't ask a lot of questions, Aunt Joanne. They're not going to answer them. And, oh, by the way, they're not going to care about what is in archives. No one's going to ask that or answer that question. Okay, fine, Jennifer, you decide the question. So she did. She came up with free text, multiple choice, some with more than one choice. And as you can see, the range here did go up to 25. 43 respondents, most of them female, surprisingly, maybe not so surprising. And in fact, these were maybe an unforeseen outcome, but which I should have seen, was my approach here ended up that most of the people also were either friends or somehow knew my niece. And so what we find here is the geographic locations. The green, that big green, that's Illinois. She lives in Illinois along with me. The other green piece there is Wisconsin, so she obviously knows some folks up there. But we did get a little representation from, it's an international survey. We got somebody from New Zealand, Scotland, and England. So it's representative, don't you think? Okay, so I'm going to share with you just a little bit of this. And again, as I said, I don't know that it'll all be really new news to you, but it's interesting to think about here. So one of the questions was, which of these technologies do you use on a daily basis? Not surprisingly, handwritten letters is kind of small. And the face-to-face and email, text messaging and phone calling, and of course, Facebook. So notice here, guys, Twitter is just not on their radar. So I don't know if that means that Twitter is actually an old technology for older people, or they're just making something that's even more cool than Twitter that they'll be using in the future here. Do you take pictures with some sort of digital device? Guess what? The green never box, it's the one significant thing of this slide is that nobody never takes pictures with digital devices today. So young people are doing it, more of them more regularly than the sometimes group. Now it gets a little bit interesting. Do you upload these pictures to some personal web space? I made her asked that. She really didn't want to because she probably fits into that never category here. But some do regularly and many do occasionally. And now here's the one that I particularly like is how do you store your digital media? And again, we might have suspected this, but the personal computer is where they're storing most of this. Flash drives, those that do the upload to their web space, they did that, and they're still doing some printing. Nobody said they didn't save anything. One person, probably one of those 10 or 12-year-old boys, has a Lego network where he's putting his stuff. So again, I mean, this is the understandable either disinterest in the concept of archives and archiving and archivists or unawareness. But this is where the information is that young people are collecting. Now we get into a couple of the text questions. So in your wildest dreams, how do you imagine the technology that your grandchildren will be having available to them? Teleportation and mind melds were kind of big ticket items here. There's a strong interest in the all-in-one technologies, easy transport systems. There is the notion of the chip in people's brains, touchless computers. And I realize that in some ways these children aren't as creative as I would hope for, because some of this is, of course, now on the horizon, if not in our hands. Now, the hovering cars or flying cars, we still don't, I haven't seen them in operation yet, but, and then the brain injection, I think, comes from the Matrix movie. So, and this one, though, somebody does believe that paper will be obsolete by the time they have grandchildren. So just a couple of direct quotes from what people entered here. I like this, that they're going to sit back and then they're going to talk to people in their flying cars on other planets. And honestly, I think everything is going to be run by some sort of technology, and my grandchildren's social skills are going to be slacking. So we're already planning, you know, the social science people, social workers, if you want to get in on a good field, there's going to be a lot of dysfunctional young people. This one, my grandchildren are really going to get to know me by listening to a recording of my voice and looking at all my pictures and... however they are, whether they're digital or otherwise. So they're expecting some digital content, representations of their lives, to be available to their grandchildren. And it would be cool if I could make a 3D virtual tour of where I live, and then they can take a tour when they're old enough. And I hesitate to ask where you live that you have to wait until they're old enough, but nonetheless, that they wanted to put that out there. Okay, and then... I think that in the future, the need for personal relations will be gone. Certainly not language skills and spelling. I have a feeling that all things will become automated, and the need to leave our homes will be less and less. So kind of a sad note there. But what we're seeing is that it's from one side to the other of embracing technology. So the other question where we get was a text-based answer this, please. What is an archives? The one that's my favorite is the response that an archives is a native. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, it's in terms of organic and original information, maybe there's some relation there. But there is this notion of safe places to store things and the concept of a place. So an archives is a place for old stuff, in particular the historic old stuff, and maybe on a special topic. They also generally talked about it as a collection. And most of the respondents were in the 17 to 20-year bracket, so that's something to keep in mind, because I was surprised that some of this seemed to be just as on spot as it is here. For future reflection, for safekeeping, okay, and a document or a resource that is an archive, and it's a file or artifact of intrinsic or emotional value. So I think that this is... this is where, you know, it leads me to recognizing that even young people with all their fanciful ideas of mind melds are able to appreciate this notion of there's still intrinsic and emotional value, even if their future grandchildren will have no social skills. But I think on a little bit more of a personal note here, I have a bit of a true confession to make, and I've thought about doing this at SAA for a while, and this presentation seems the best to do it. And prior to associating with archivists, I did not have much of an education in or appreciation for history. And I say that because I just want you to understand, for any of you that do have a longstanding experience as an archivist, that during my time in this position, I find myself becoming really interested in history, and it seems that many of my archivist friends put up with my ignorance and are always happy to share more information with me. And one day, I was working in, yes, the Archivist for Electronic Records, was working with physical artifacts, drawings of the building that I work in, which is the main library in the University of Illinois campus. And I was coming up these stairs, and they're the main stairs that go up to the reference room. And as I was going up the stairs, I realized I had just moments ago been working with the architectural drawings of the building where the details on the iron railing there that showed the little corn cobs was just in my hand. And I'd never before even noticed that they were corn cobs. And it was such a cool experience for me. And then I looked at the stairs where the impression of all the thousands of feet that had walked before mine had slowly, slowly placed what seemed like, I'm sure, an invisible footstep on that granite and wore it down little by little. And I began to get this sense of history in a way that I had never experienced before. And even going to the restroom, this little pedestal spot here, as I was going in, I had walked by this a million times before, and as I was working with these architectural records, there were some details of this little alcove where it showed the bust of Lloyd Morey, who was the man whose bust was used to be there, and it was stolen by some frat boys, I think. But I had suddenly I made this connection with this other place that I walked by on a regular basis, because now I knew what this invisible man looked like, and I began and I finally read what it said. The guy was the president of the university. I never paid attention, and so I just want you to know that I come from a background that does not lend itself to necessarily make me be a good archivist, but by working with materials and working around archivists, I've grown to appreciate the profession more. And this is in my same little trek of wandering about the building that day. We've got the tablets here on the wall that show the names of students that have reached great levels of academic accomplishment. And those names started to pop out at me and became real. And suddenly I saw these real people that were in the same building I was in. And I have this to thank to the archives profession and to my colleagues for it. And I think that that's where, you know, what it tells me is that even though technology isn't going away, people are going to be keeping more stuff themselves, and they're still going to rely on safe places for it. And number four, to me, is really important, that archivists shouldn't lose sight of their foundational perspectives, and that you're not going to be going it alone, and there are ways to work together with the technologists. But let's not lose sight of what archivists are all about. So anyway, and I had this small video to juxtapose against what Nan showed you for a couple of reasons. So it's metaphorical, so it's kind of dorky, but too bad. You're going to see it anyway, unless you walk out real soon here. And but it also is an interesting comparison of what it means to really know what you're doing with video and what it means to just be playing with it for the first time. So what you're going to see is something that has some material from some of the people who answered the survey are incorporated and their ideas are incorporated into it, but I have to take the credit or blame for putting it together in a movie, okay? So I would apologize if I knew how, but I don't, and so therefore what I'm going to do is try to turn this into a movie that is at least okay.
Night. I need you to rescue my daughter. That will be a trivial matter, Your Majesty. I will save her as soon as it is humanly possible. Ah, thank you, Sir Clement. Thank you very much.
too much.
So they let me in the building on a Sunday. Anyway, thank you for indulging me with that, but the point of it is to remind us that there's room to play in this new future of digital content in a lot of different ways, but we really don't want to forget about the core of what archivists are all about and what they provide to our culture as a whole. So thank you.
So we were in locked doors because I can tell you this one. We were all working.
Well, we did end with enough time to open up for questions. If anyone has any questions, and three very different presentations, I hope we entertained and made you think a little about what archivists mean now. Any questions? Jackie.
I have a question about somewhat simplified. How about a universe streamline? Where's the University Archives? But nonetheless, recapitulated it. This is what television.
All of the above, yeah. I've been working a lot with stations in different contexts and things like that. I had the experience not too long ago where I was invited to Lincoln, Nebraska, where they have a very robust statewide public broadcasting service that includes both statewide public radio and television, a lot of distance learning, and of course they also have a lot of sports. So they have a very large archives. Plus, I think they're the repository for the state legislative activities, so they've got all the video from the legislature and the governor's press conferences and things like that. So it's very mixed. They invited me to come and speak with them really about setting up a collaboration. And I didn't know who they were going to be inviting, and it turned out they invited people from across the university because the broadcasters are nominally connected to the university, though they're no longer under the direct control of the university, I believe, including the library school, the people doing all the web and internet activities, and the people doing the broadcast operations who have the programs on the shelves. They invited the state historian, the Nebraska State Museum, the state archivist, the Digital Humanities Center, and they threw in a couple of other folks. So there was a room of 30 people there, and I was completely unprepared for that, but they were really thinking collaboratively, what will it take to set up a collaboration for shared information and shared resources where they knew no single entity could do it by themselves, but together they could probably come up with something that they could even go to the state with and say, all of these groups are cooperating, and so the investment will be actually manageable, because everyone isn't going to come back asking for their own thing. So I guess that's kind of a long answer to say, can you set up some kind of a working group or an introductory session or a briefing and bring in a few people that represent some of these different interests? I mean, even some of the things that Lisa was saying where, you know, she, you know, they're now working with different parts of the university on the issues that they're concerned about, but the other departments are working about, so that it's not just sort of you and them, even though that might be enough, but that this is broader than just you and them. It includes some of the technology people. It includes maybe, you know, a couple of other departments or maybe even one other department. I don't know if you've got media studies, if you've got history, if you've got early, you know, like I said, K through 12. All of these people are interested in being able to think that they'll help save the materials. So maybe some kind of a working group that represents something a little bit broader than those two departments in terms of thinking about where to start. Because where to start, putting together a plan that has phases and things like that, that's not too difficult. Those kinds of steps are fairly familiar to all of us. You might need some different expertise in that, but the steps for what you need to do first and what are the things that have to be put in place, that's not a hard thing to do. But the best thing that you can do is put together some collaboration and participation so that people have buy-in on it, and it'll make everybody happy.
Other questions?
Yeah, let me get to that in just a minute. I realize I hadn't answered your question about introduction to the American Archive to the broadcasters. My personal opinion is that right now the outreach for the American Archive is not being done very well. I'm hoping that we can broaden it out because people are really looking for support and they will have money to invest in local archiving projects. But if you want to go to your broadcasting folks and say, we know there's the American Archive, now go to the CPB website or go to your regular technical or programming engineering listservs and things like that and make sure you get the information. It's not mysterious, it's just they might have to hunt it down because it may or may not be getting to the right people about it. But it's starting to get out there, and if I have anything to say about it, it'll be more. The question about rights, the American Archive hasn't, it's just starting to look at the rights issues, but some of us who are involved with planning it have been in working for a while, and I can't say that I know for certain that they've been working with that group that you mentioned, but we definitely have been working with the archives of recorded, the Society of Recorded Sound Archives. We have done a lot of work, particularly with the Library of Congress Section 108 study group, a lot of the issues that are coming out right now in terms of copyright and preservation. And a lot of research has been done within public broadcasting itself on the rights issues related to the materials that we have, which the broadcast materials have somewhat different conditions than recorded sound per se, but it cuts across all of those sort of recorded media things. And copyright access to sound is really different from copyright access to video and this and this and that and that. And some of it is just figuring out the other piece of that, of course, is fair use and how much people are willing to kind of push that envelope and how much it's appropriate in our instance. And in fact, I was thinking as we were watching a little video that we just saw. I bet you didn't clear any of that stuff for public performance. It's all fair use, right? So you said. It could be public domain, but probably not. The Hubble stuff would be, yeah, because that's government. But that doesn't mean that it was fair use. Just because you got it from the kids?
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is that these things are very complicated, and I think that your point is well taken, that we really need, the American Archive needs to be conscientious about working with all the groups that are interested in reforming the laws to be more favorable to what we need.
Other questions? I'm going to repeat the question. The question was about paper-sparse offices and Lisa's use of the term, and if she's being asked if she can give some examples. Define and give examples.
Well, Cynthia has been, giving the presentation, so can I defer to you or to answer that question?
Sure. Okay. Sure. In the university, at Michigan State University, as we're implementing a new enterprise-wide business system, and we also have a lot of green initiatives going on, and I believe this is from the business world, where you're using less and less paper in your offices, and instead of going to a paperless office, which doesn't seem to be a reality, someone else coined the term of paper sparse, where you have less and less amounts of paper, and we're trying to come with imaging workflows and much more of an automated workflow in the business offices. So our administrative units are doing that. And our vice president actually said it at a meeting that I was at, and I glommed onto it. Other questions? All right. Well, thank you guys very much. Thank our speakers.